With Master Dooku, those reactions weren't so different. "I'll take the holocron back," Qui-Gon promised. That was the only thing he could think of to do. "I won't ever bring it here again, I promise."
"My worry is not that you're studying the holocron here. It's that you're studying it at all," Dooku said.
He didn't sound as angry anymore, though. Maybe he was calming down. Qui-Gon hoped so.
"You'll keep looking at it, won't you? Regardless of what I tell you."
Disappointment made Qui-Gon slump in his chair.
"I won't disobey you, Master. If you tell me not to study the holocron, I'll leave it alone for as long as I'm your Padawan."
Dooku drew himself upright, folding his arms.
"Which means you'll study it thereafter."
Qui-Gon hadn't thought that far ahead, but now that he did...
"Maybe," he admitted, "if I'm still interested."
"You will be."
Dooku walked away from him, staring out the window at the bustle of Coruscant. After a long pause, Qui-Gon realized his master would say nothing more. He closed the holocron and left Dooku's quarters, determined to go straight to the archives with it and never to disappoint his master again. That night, however, Qui-Gon couldn't rest.
"The holocron contains the prophecies, and the prophecies tell us the future."
How could anyone not want to know the future if they could? He flopped over in his bed, groaning.
"That isn't the dark side. That's just being awake, isn't it?"
Qui-Gon had already made so many connections that he thought might be borne out. It was a mistake, he thought, assuming that the prophecies still referred to his future. They'd been made nearly 10,000 years ago, and surely some had since come to pass. The prophecy about the woman who was born to and would give birth to darkness. That might refer to an ancient Duchess of Malastare, whose father had waged wars that were vicious even by Malastarian standards, and whose daughter had become a dark Jedi. Another prophecy said the Sith would disappear yet appear again. Most of the notes on this prophecy interpreted it as the potential reincarnation of the Sith Order. But Qui-Gon wondered whether it might not be referring to a specific Sith, a legendary Darth Rend, who had been believed dead but returned to wage war against the Jedi once more. But he shouldn't even be thinking about that. Not if he wanted to be a good apprentice to Dooku. Qui-Gon pulled his blankets over his head and tried to go to sleep. The next morning, sleepy and grumpy, Qui-Gon made himself presentable and headed to Dooku's quarters. He expected another lecture and maybe even some extra duties as penance.
"As my master wills it," he thought to himself.
But when he walked through the door, he saw Dooku sitting at the same table Qui-Gon had been sitting at the day before, with the holocron of prophecy open in front of him. In its golden light, Dooku's face looked younger than Qui-Gon had ever seen it.
"Padawan," Dooku said, "it occurs to me that if you'll be studying this anyway, it only makes sense for you to do so with the proper guidance. Someone to make sure you don't go too far."
Qui-Gon grinned.
"You mean you'll teach me yourself?"
"It's my responsibility," Dooku replied. "As your master."
He never looked away from the holocron.
Chapter 24.
"All hail Her Serene Highness!"
called the Tribune. Cheers rose from the crowd within the central metropolitan dome of the capital city, a gathering as large and cheerful as any Rael Avaros had seen in his 8 years on Pygel. He'd personally seen to it. Avaros stood on the hover platform with Fanry, watching her wave to her subjects. She had been kept sequestered in the palace complex for most of her youth, meaning she was still somewhat awkward at such huge public gatherings. It was perhaps Avaros's final duty as a regent to help Fenri get accustomed to the role of queen. Even a constitutional monarch had to be able to own the spotlight. Certainly Fenri looked the part. Her dress and headscarf were a pale enough green to meet Pyjali standards of outer plainness, but the rich gold embroidery glinted subtly in the dome lights. She held herself proud and tall. Well, as tall as the little thing could manage. Katie helped her up on a step where the princess could be better seen by the crowd. The rally had been extensively promoted. Avaros had seen to that, and Zerka Corporation had been sharp enough to offer free transportation to those from outer provinces. Many of these cheering, flag-waving citizens had bustled off Zerka ships just a few hours ago, eager for their first trip to the Capitol Dome. And every single one of them had been searched and scanned. No slicer darts would get inside today. Cam droids hovered around the platform, getting good footage of the striking young princess, who would soon be Pygel's queen. Avaros had made good and sure none of them focused on him for long. It had been a long time since public attention had been welcome. In his mind, a memory flickered. The council chambers. Yoda shaking his head sorrowfully.
Mourn we Nimpiana's death. Too soon and unnecessary it was.
Walking along the temple corridors afterward, stares burning into him like lasers, hearing echoes of Nim and the voice of every Padawan, his already depthless anguish somehow made worse by the knowledge that every single person around him blamed him as much as he blamed himself. They'd never wanted him here, never thought he belonged, and his failure had proved them right. Avaros snapped out of it. This wasn't about Nim, not any longer. It was about Fenri. Guard platforms hovered around the edge of the crowd as the royal orchestras began warming up for the celebration concert. Captain Darren rode atop the largest one, his vigilant eyes forever examining the perimeters. As Avaros watched, Darren suddenly straightened, as though in alarm. Then, relaxed. Avaros followed the captain's gaze to another platform that had just entered the arena.
Good. It's just Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan. Maybe they've had some luck up there on the moon, dragging opposition scum out in the open.
Once Fenri had been guided to the royal box, Katie carrying her train, Avaros gestured that he'd return later. Listening to fancy music never was one of his favorite pastimes, and he wanted to hear what Qui-Gon had learned. So he thought.
And you believed that?
Rael said, pacing in front of Qui-Gon.
A bunch of blaster-carrying thugs surround you in the forest, and then they tell you they're not actually dangerous, and you bought every word of it?
I'm not naive, Qui-Gon replied. Obviously, Hayla Nazaka's story has to be thoroughly questioned. But a group of performance artists isn't what I'd call thugs. And everything she said fits the fact patterns we'd observed before.
Rael shot back.
You mean the lady knows how to tell a really good lie?
Qui-Gon had known this would surprise Rael. He hadn't understood that it would enrage him. He took a moment to be grateful that he'd sent Obi-Wan back to the palace. Apparently, he'd need to draw on their old friendship to get through to Rael at all, and that was more easily done with his apprentice absent. However, Obi-Wan had accompanied Qui-Gon as far as the dome perimeter, so he too had seen the jarring artificiality of this ceremony. Protesters were relatively few, but they'd been cordoned off into an area that allowed them no access to the interior of the dome. The final attendees had been filtering in as he and Obi-Wan arrived, collecting flags, banners, and other previously prepared items to show their support for the princess and the governance treaty. To judge by their smiles, Qui-Gon suspected the attendees genuinely were happy about the coming changes, But this group had nonetheless been carefully curated to present a uniformity of opinion that didn't actually exist.
How many of the Pyjali understand Zerka's role in all this? He wondered. How many of them have lost friends or relatives to slavery?
Probably a great many, none of whom were inside the dome. Rael brought them to an antechamber at the rim of the dome for their conversation. It was a small space, cramped and claustrophobic, or maybe it just felt that way, with Rael's fury so great that it drew the air out of the room.
They admitted they were behind some of it,
Rael said, still pacing.
Admitted it. And you're still trying to give them a free pass.
They admitted to political stunts, not any acts of violence. And as I see it, the fact that they admitted to some crimes makes their denial of the others more persuasive, not less.
Qui-Gon said.
Rael's first response was a sneer. As you see it. You always had a weakness for seeing what you wanted to see, Qui-Gon. Always were a soft touch for a sad story. Helena Zucker sized you up pretty good.
This wasn't entirely untrue. Qui-Gon refused to be ashamed of it.
I attempt to understand the viewpoints of everyone I deal with. That's not a weakness. That's how I operate. And I've learned more that way than I ever would by being too quick to cast blame.
Best case scenario, they're still criminals,
Rael retorted.
And I don't believe in her best case scenario. So why are you in here arguing their case?
Because I've undertaken a preliminary review of the treaty, and it appears to me that many of the opposition's criticisms are well-founded. If the phrase, preserved as the sun preserves the moon, means what she claims it means, that it means forever, beyond amendment, then the treaty is deeply flawed.
Qui-Gon currently had Obi-Wan doing a much more thorough review, so tomorrow he'd be able to raise specific objections. For today, he just wanted to get Rael to listen.
There isn't much representation of lunar citizens in the proposed assembly. The moon is ruled by Pyjal.
Always has been.
Rael's voice had taken on a thick veneer of contempt.
Since when does our mandate as Jedi allow us to change the way things have always been done on a planet?
You're Lord Regent Rael.
The Council wouldn't have named you to the position and expected you to do nothing. Your mandate is to help govern a world. And if you're willing to shift from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional one, why shouldn't the status of lunar citizens be re-examined as well?
Because that's not how things work here. Fenri's still going to be queen of both Pyjal and its moon.
Rael was smarter than this. His zeal to preserve Fenri's power and status had gotten the better of him. Qui-Gon had to find a way to get past his anger. Then perhaps Rael would listen. He needed to turn the discussion to something further from the princess.
The treaty tacitly gives Zerka Corporation immense power,
Qui-Gon began. Their contracts will effectively be enshrined in law.
So what? Zerka might even be older than the Republic. They've got contracts all over the galaxy. That's probably never going to change, not on Pyjal or anywhere else,
Rael said.
Zerka's not in charge of the penal system all over the galaxy. They're not claiming every planet's citizens as forced labor.
Rael scoffed. Pyjal's hardly the only planet that punishes crime with long terms of labor.
That doesn't make it right, Qui-Gon said. And this isn't just long-term, it's permanent.
This made no impression.
Is this your first time on the fringes of the Republic? Is this seriously the first time you've seen proof that this exists? Because if not, I don't know where this attitude is coming from.
Qui-Gon paused.
Punishing crime with forced labor isn't traditional on Pyjal. You yourself just said, you're not here to change the way things have always been done,
and you yourself just tried to make me change things.
Rael's face had flushed as deep a red as it did in battle.
Listen, Qui-Gon, you're not here to help draft the treaty.
That's already been done, and done well, with no assistance from you. You're here to make sure the treaty gets signed. Because until that treaty is signed, Fanry doesn't have the authority to make permanent agreements with other worlds. Once the new assembly has that authority, they can establish the hyperspace corridor, and once that's done, Pygel has a new future. Fanry can rule on a world that's safe and stable and prosperous. I've done everything in my power to create that for her, and I don't understand why you want to interfere with that.
Qui-Gon waited several seconds before responding.
As you said, the treaty's already been drafted. Who drafted it, Rael?
That finally made Rael pause.
Okay, so we had some help from the local Zerka supervisor. But merit calls solid. She's done a lot of good on Pygel, perhaps incidentally,
Qui-Gon said.
But I assure you, she's only ever been working for the benefit of Zerka Corporation, not for the good of this planet.
In this case, they're one and the same,
Rael insisted. Qui-Gon held on to his temper only with the greatest difficulty.
That's not possible.
Music began filtering into the room from the dome. Apparently, the orchestra had begun playing the triumphal symphony composed for Fanry's coronation. The gentle strains of the overture almost seemed to be mocking their anger. Rael finally said,
Zerka's authority helps the treaty. The treaty helps Fanry hold on to the most important parts of her royal power, while allowing her to finally have a halfway normal life. So I'm not backing down.
Your role as Lord Regent is about more than protecting the princess.
Sorrowfully, Qui-Gon shook his head.
You have a responsibility to all the citizens of Pygel, including those who live on its moon.
You know who I don't have a responsibility to?
Terrorists that have already bombed multiple municipal buildings and are going to try to interfere with the treaty.
The same treaty that's going to guarantee a good future for Fanry and for Pygel.
Rael lifted his chin.
And I don't have a responsibility to anybody who tries to get in the treaty's way.
A rap on the door startled them both. Qui-Gon turned to see Merit Kahl walking in, wearing her best suit and an obsequious smile.
Lord Regent, the music has already begun. We're expecting you in the Zerka box, since, after all, you wanted Fanry to have the spotlight to herself during the concert.
Yeah, Rael said. She deserves it. Let's go.
Qui-Gon could only watch as Rael offered his arm to the Zerka supervisor and walked away.
Chapter 25.
After the Capitol Dome event, the palace turned chilly, in a way that had nothing to do with drafts or the sharp winds from the sea. Princess Fanry herself seemed oblivious to any strife, but Rael Avaros's rage had shifted from hot to cold. From his long experience with Rael, Qui-Gon knew this was a dangerous shift.
If he didn't need me to ratify the governance treaty in 2 days, Qui-Gon thought, Rael would throw us out of the palace tonight.
And surely Rael suspected that Qui-Gon now hoped not to ratify that treaty. Meeting with Obi-Wan in the palace library afterward only confirmed his worst fears.
These are the official census results, his Padawan said, bringing up the charts on a datapad screen. But by going into local census records, I was able to pull other sets of numbers, which I suspect are more accurate. It turns out Halen Nazaka was wrong about 25% of Pyjali citizens living on the moon. It's closer to 30%.
Although Obi-Wan spoke in a low voice, every word echoed slightly in the cavernous marble-tiled library. The room showed signs of infrequent use. Dusty window panes, out-of-date data solids, no resident droids to speak of. But it was hard not to feel paranoid that someone might be spying on them. Rael Avaros, Halen Nazaka, the mysterious Black Guards. All of them would have their reasons for wanting to eavesdrop on the Jedi and
for planning to intervene if they didn't like what they heard. Besides, there was still a traitor in their midst. Qui-Gon scratched his beard, as he often did when deep in thought.
In other words, this treaty gives the vote to 70% of the people on the Pygil system, while nearly disenfranchising the other 30%.
Exactly. And that doesn't even count those they've enslaved.
Obi-Wan pressed the data pad to bring up holographic data.
As for the role Zerka Corporation plays in Pygil, everything we've been told is true. Avaros didn't start the process of allowing Zerka to take over so many parts of the government. They've been here for generations. But he definitely accelerated it. And yes, the phrase about the sun preserving the moon turns out to be legally binding in a very permanent sense. The governance treaty would set Zerka's monopoly here in stone.
I can understand why Avaros wouldn't know the traditional power of that phrase. What I can't understand is why he let anyone else draft the Constitution, much less anyone from Zerka. And yet he did it out of loyalty to the Princess.
Qui-Gon still felt guilt about the many failures he'd had as Obi-Wan's master, but at least he hadn't smothered him in falsehoods as Rael had Fanry. The very acts Rael thought were for her benefit were the ones that would mire her rule and her planet in corruption. Obi-Wan's voice broke his reverie.
How do we proceed, Master?
We begin by contacting the Jedi Council,
Qui-Gon said. How odd to think that someday soon he would be the one other Jedi contacted for advice, that his judgment would supersede that of the individuals who were on the scene, actually dealing with the problems at hand.
I'll handle that myself. You get some rest. It was a hard day for you.
I'm still shaking dust out of my clothes,
Obi-Wan confessed.
A bath has never sounded so good.
He could joke about nearly dying in a sinkhole, not even 6 hours after the event. Qui-Gon once again realized what a fine Padawan he'd had, and what a shame it was they'd failed to get on. Just before Obi-Wan reached the door, Qui-Gon called,
Padawan!
Obi-Wan half turned to listen as Qui-Gon continued.
Sorry to stick you with yet more library duty.
He was answered with a broad smile.
Compared with clinging to a log for dear life, research isn't half bad.
What was evening for the Palace of Pygil turned out to be the middle of the night for the Jedi Temple. Only one member was available to speak immediately, but it was the one member whose judgment was most likely to be final.
Troubling this is,
Yoda said.
To Chancellor Kaj, I must speak.
Of course, Kaj would have reviewed the treaty. But she wouldn't have understood the full meaning of that ritual phrase, and so hadn't seen the trouble it would cause.
Do you think she'll withdraw the treaty? Or at least ensure amendments?
Yoda's ears drooped.
Difficult to say. Ready to retire, the Chancellor is. Surrounded by planetary ministers, corporate interests, and others who desire her influence in the final days of her rule. Complications in this matter will not be easily brought to her attention.
Something must be done, Qui-Gon said. I cannot in good conscience represent the Republic at the ceremony, not unless the treaty is changed.
Careful, Qui-Gon.
Yoda's holographic image blurred momentarily as the tiny Jedi Master adjusted himself in his bowl chair.
Jeopardize the hyperspace corridor. You must not.
The hyperspace. Master Yoda, forgive me, but are you putting the profit of corporations ahead of the people of Pygil?
Qui-Gon had long thought the Council was in danger of losing its way, but this was colder than he would have imagined possible. Yoda pulled himself upright, ears rising.
Serve planets long cut off, this corridor will. Planets struggling with poverty and famine. Will you save Pygil at the cost of their lives? Is this how you will serve the Force?
Forgive me. I spoke in haste.
And, Qui-Gon knew,
in repressed anger at Yoda's no vote against him. This was unworthy of them both, and he strove to set the feeling aside. However, the essential problem remains. We cannot neglect others to save Pygel, but in turn, we cannot neglect Pygel to save others.
Reason with Avaros, you cannot.
Yoda said in a tone that suggested long experience.
This assignment, we thought to help him. Always he has felt himself to be alone, to be judged and found wanting. Thought we that as regent, he would struggle no more for status. His pride would be fed. Instead, it has only fueled his weaknesses.
Qui-Gon thought again of the laughing young man who had stood by him before he went into his first battle. At the time, Rael Avaros had seemed like the bravest, best Jedi Knight the Order could produce. Qui-Gon had been too young to see the cracks in the bravado, the pain that all Dooku's guidance and all Rael's accomplishments had never been able to erase.
But he would effectively sell citizens into slavery.
Grievous this is.
Yoda agreed. Into Qui-Gon's mind came the echo of Rahara Wick.
What's the point of having a republic in the first place?
We should put an end to it,
he said. Yoda shook his head.
Not ours to decide. The fate of the treaty is...
Not the treaty. Slavery.
Qui-Gon folded his hands in front of him, allowing the robes to obscure them, the most formal way in which a Jedi could address another.
Why do we allow this barbarism to flourish? The Republic could use its influence to promote abolition in countless systems where the practice flourishes. How can we fail to do this?
Yoda remained silent for a few moments before saying,
Know of the planet Uro, do you? Devour their weakest children, they do.
They're arachnids, whose instincts are unstoppable.
What abyss?
When Qui-Gon shook his head no, Yoda said,
When their elderly grow too old to regenerate, beat them to death, the abyss undo, to conserve their resources.
Qui-Gon's patience began to wear thin.
This isn't about imposing human ethics on non-human species. This is something humans do to one another, an atrocity we should put an end to.
We? Not the Chancellor, not the Galactic Senate, not even the people of the Republic, but the Jedi?
Yoda thumped his gimmer stick on the floor.
Want to rule, do you? Dangerous this is in one who would join the Council. Dangerous it is in any Jedi.
Qui-Gon knew all of this. On one level, he accepted the truth of it. On the other,
if we don't stand for the right, what do we do? Why do we exist?
Many ways there are of serving the right.
Yoda replied.
We work within our mandates, and there do as much good as we can. To do otherwise, to substitute our judgment for that of the Republic, is to repeat the mistakes of the past.
So instead we make different mistakes in the present.
Qui-Gon kept this to himself. A galactic crusade against slavery beyond the reaches of the Republic would need to be larger than one angry Jedi Knight. But enslavement here on Pygel, that was within his mandate. And it would not stand. He said only,
You'll talk to the Chancellor as soon as possible.
Yoda nodded.
Well you have done to reveal the shortcomings of the treaty.
Praise from Yoda was rare, and Qui-Gon tried to take satisfaction in it. Yet it was difficult for him to go to sleep that night. He stood in the Celestial Chalice, the curved amphitheater to the ancient gods within the Pajali Palace. This was the place for the treaty ceremony, and everything was about to begin. Fanry walked toward him, her dress shining white, her brilliant red hair hanging free, her clothing all the more vivid against the dark blue tiled floor of the chalice. And everything went mad, turned into a jumble Qui-Gon couldn't comprehend. People screamed. Minister Orth pushed roughly through the crowd toward the altar. Rael shouted, "Fanry, no!" Qui-Gon brought up his lightsaber ready to strike, but at what? At whom? Something had to be done. Qui-Gon opened his eyes. He lay in his bed, far from the celestial chalice. It felt as though he had traveled through time and back again. The events yet to come were more real to him than the sheets, the mattress, the sound of his own breath. Another vision granted by the Force, he thought. No, more of the same vision. Another angle. A deeper look. Maybe, or maybe he was only dreaming. There was no way to tell. Or was there? He put on his robe and hurried out into the palace corridors. This late at night, they were utterly deserted, save for one astromech burbling along the floor on its errands. Qui-Gon's feet, still bare, were chilled by the marble floors, and when he went by the windows, he heard the soft rushing of the tides. During their first day on Pygel, Rael had talked Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan through the details of the ceremony, gesturing toward two large plain wooden doors at the end of the royal reception hall. Those doors opened onto a tunnel, which led directly to the celestial chalice. They were opened only when the monarch went to the chalice for one of the momentous ceremonies that took place only two or three times in a reign. Luckily, the hinges were kept oiled. As he walked into the tunnel, two sentry droids with Zerka logos scanned him. They weren't programmed to ask questions, only to recognize previously approved individuals and attack all others. Qui-Gon felt relieved he'd already been entered into the system, and that Rael Avaros's temper hadn't led to his deletion. Yet. The tunnel was dark, illuminated only by a few candle droids spaced far apart. But everything the tunnel lacked in visibility, it provided in audibility. Qui-Gon heard other footsteps ahead of him, coming his way. He readied himself, one hand on his lightsaber's hilt. Someone yelped in fright, then swore.
"Sacred bats, what are you doing here?"
"Minister Orth." Qui-Gon stepped forward to see her, still wearing her bronze-colored court dress from earlier in the evening. "I might ask you the same question."
"I'm double-checking security procedures," she snapped. "It's too important a job to be left to Zerka droids."
"I quite agree."
"You haven't answered my question."
Orth folded her arms in front of her chest.
"What are you doing here?"
"I wanted to have a look at the celestial chalice for myself before the ceremony."
"You could have had anyone give you a tour during the day," Orth said, "which would make sense and provide a better view. But as you will."
She hustled back toward the palace, apparently satisfied with this explanation. Qui-Gon wondered if he should be satisfied with hers. He continued on until he reached the other set of doors, which were carved of the same smooth white stone found on the cliffs by the sea. These swung open easily at his touch, revealing the celestial chalice in all its glory. And Qui-Gon had seen it before. The gilding around the lower edges of the domed ceiling, the octagonal altar, the arrangement of the seats around it, every single detail matched. When he looked down at his own bare feet, he saw the bright blue tile beneath them. "It was exactly like this in my dream," he thought, then caught himself. What Qui-Gon had experienced was no dream. It was a vision.
Chapter 26. "I will not take part in the treaty ceremony," Qui-Gon said. "The Republic will have no representative, and therefore the treaty cannot go forward."
Were the stakes any less important, he might have been amused by the reactions around the banquet table. Obi-Wan's eyes widened. Minister Orth dropped her knife.
Captain Darren squinted at Qui-Gon as though his vision had suddenly gone blurry. Little Fanry bit her lip, maybe not to smile at the astonished adults around her. Rael, as expected, was furious. Rising to his feet, he said,
"You raised your objections yesterday, Qui-Gon. I told you then, it's not your decision to make.
This isn't about my personal opinion. It's about a vision of the future, a warning, given to me by the Force."
Remembering the images from his dream and the sheer feeling of horror that bound them together steeled him against any objections. Qui-Gon knew what he knew.
"Why did I ever show you those prophecies?"
Rael shook his head as he paced the length of the table.
"Dooku had the sense to keep them from you, but I didn't know any better. I figured you were smart enough to tell legend from fact. I assumed you weren't a fool who'd lose your head over other Jedi's visions, much less your own. Well, Qui-Gon, you proved me wrong."
Minister Orth put her head in one hand.
"Prophecies? This just keeps getting worse."
Was it still possible to reach Rael on any level at all? If so, Qui-Gon knew, it would be in their shared past.
"You showed me the work of the ancient Jedi mystics, the work you collected with our master, because it expanded your understanding of the Force and helped to expand mine. Dooku believed in them. Will you call him a fool too?"
Orth said,
"Who is this Dooky?"
From her place at her gilded chair, mouthful of breakfast, Fanry said,
"Dooku. I've heard lots of stories about him. He taught Rael and Qui-Gon both, but I don't think he's a Jedi anymore."
Rael gestured at the child.
"That's right. Dooku left the Order because he got sick and tired of the hypocrisy, the judgment, all of it."
"I don't know why Dooku left the Order," Qui-Gon said, "and neither do you. What I do know is that I've had two separate visions that predict disaster at the treaty ceremony."
Captain Darren finally spoke.
"What kind of disaster?"
Qui-Gon admitted,
"It's unclear."
"Unclear?"
With one fist, Rael pounded the table.
"You want to sabotage the coronation and the hyperspace corridor for something that's unclear?"
"What's not unclear is the screaming I hear in the visions."
Qui-Gon looked around the banqueting table, piled high with more breakfast than a dozen courts could ever eat, making eye contact with each person in turn.
"Nor fighting with a lightsaber. Nor blood on the floor of the Celestial Chalice. And if any of you could feel the fear and despair that came with that vision, that is as much a part of it as any image or sound. You wouldn't doubt this any more than I do."
Minister Orth put her hands on her hips.
"I ran into you last night headed to the Celestial Chalice. Are you sure you weren't sleepwalking?"
"No, Minister. I was checking details from my vision against the reality of the Chalice. Even though I had never been inside it before, I had seen it all, precisely as it is, down to the tiles on the floor."
"Cool,"
Fanry breathed.
"Does that mean we can't have a treaty ceremony?"
"We're signing the treaty,"
Rael insisted, "on schedule as planned. The Jedi Council will soon set Qui-Gon right."
Qui-Gon had not yet shared his vision with the Council, nor did he intend to. They would spend all their time bickering about the viability of the hyperspace corridor. They were too bound to Coruscant, too bound to the Chancellor, too far from the living Force. They were no longer the sort of Jedi who could trust in a pure vision. It shocked him that he was that Jedi, that he could still find it in him to believe so profoundly, so unshakably, in pure mysticism. Qui-Gon had often felt out of step with the Order as a whole, but never to this degree. He had also never felt this close to the Force.
Brahara Wick had received instructions from Qui-Gon Jinn the day before, requesting that the Merricks check out the Zerka landing pads throughout this section of the moon. She would have done it anyway. How could she mess up Zerka's plans on this moon if she didn't know more about what those plans were? As she'd expected, Pax was less excited about their task.
I don't like this.
Have you ever liked anything, ever, since our journeys began? Besides finding jewels, I mean?
You say that as though finding jewels were incidental to our travels, rather than the entire point. But I digress.
Despite his complaints, Pax had already laid in course to the nearest Zerka facility and was already steering them in that direction.
We agreed to help the Jedi, not to do their dirty work for them.
That's before any of us knew we'd be going up against Zerka Corporation,
Rahara said, rubbing absently at the back of her left hand.
If we're taking Zerka on, we can't be scared of a little dirty work.
Soon the Zerka facility came up on the scanners, then became visible to the naked eye. Rahara began working with instruments to zero in on as many details as possible.
Looks like they've rerouted almost all energy from this hemisphere's solar generators straight into their own places, she muttered. And check out those shipment cases. What's in those?
Pax examined the readings before she could.
Ores, mostly. Not stuff found near the surface, either. These mines delve deep. Perhaps halfway to the moon's core.
Rather drastic.
Rahara nodded slowly as she recognized some of the mining droids rolling about, models she'd been familiar with since childhood.
Zerka's willing to dig the heart out of a world as long as it makes them a credit or two. The shafts get colder and colder the farther they drill down. Then it starts getting warm again and you know they're going too deep. And if they ever weaken the layer beneath you too much, the magma could boil up through it and...
She stopped herself.
That never happened to me, obviously. But I always knew it could.
Once, after her escape, Rahara allowed herself to research exactly what happened to human workers in a shaft exposed to magma. She thought knowing the details would exorcise the nightmares she'd always had about it. That had been a mistake. The details only made the dreams more real and more horrifying.
Oh, dear.
Pax leaned closer, getting between her and the dashboard. Before she could review for him the concept of personal space and why people shouldn't invade it, he said,
We appear to have, new workers coming in.
It felt as though she were back in one of the cold mine shafts again, numb all over, surrounded by darkness.
You mean new slaves?
He nodded.
Don't look.
He said in the gentle tone of voice he used so seldom.
If it will hurt you.
It will, Rahara said. But I'm gonna look.
Pax grimaced.
Willingly inflicting pain on oneself is irrational. Outside certain fetishistic pursuits, I mean.
These people deserve a witness. They deserve to have someone who cares see exactly what's happening.
Slowly... Pax nodded and leaned away from her, allowing her a view of the facility's perimeter where a large tram had been parked. Sentry droids were herding dozens of people into the warehouse. That was probably where they'd be implanted with the Zerka tag. Some of the people were crying, but most of them looked dazed and exhausted, unable to process what was happening to them. They had on the telltale gray coveralls, still crisp and new. Rahar had worn most of hers until they were threadbare.
These people are criminals, part of her mind said.
It seemed easier to blame these people in some way than to relive her own past.
They actually did something to get in this mess. They weren't born into it, like you were.
Didn't matter. Nobody deserved to live like that. No one.
That tram must have come in from the nearest town.
Rahara said. Her voice didn't tremble. She was proud of that.
We ought to go there and check it out. Land, walk around, talk to some people. We might learn a lot.
Pax replied,
I bought you
A gift.
She leaned back in her seat and closed her eyes. Awkward conversational segues were one of Pax's specialties, but this one was spectacularly weird.
Since when do we buy each other gifts?
Was he rethinking the whole rational co-workers do not get romantically involved thing? That wasn't something she could deal with right now. I propose that we buy each other gifts, he said, when we see the other has a need that has not been met.
After some fishing around in the cluttered cockpit storage compartment, he withdrew a slim rectangular box and presented it to her.
Rahara opened it, less curious than resigned, and saw a pair of gloves.
Beautiful gloves.
Gundark leather, she thought, tinted a blue so dark it looked almost black. When Rahara slipped her left hand into one, she realized the lining was some kind of shimmer silk. It was soft against the ever-tender scar. These were probably the nicest things she'd ever owned. But it wouldn't have mattered if they'd been a pair of Gamorrean underwear. The gloves were a way to protect her from Zerka and a way to help her feel less afraid. That was what made her choke up.
I got them yesterday evening when I took the facet to pick up more supplies.
Pax looked from her face to the gloves and back again, unsure what to make of her silence.
You like them?
They're wonderful,
Rahara said hoarsely. She gave him a watery smile.
You have your moments, Pax.
Bosh, he said. I'm marvelous all the time. This is simply one of those occasions when you've noticed.
There were undoubtedly many, many factors Qui-Gon had taken into account when he decided to make his announcement over breakfast. Obi-Wan knew that. He also knew that a factor Qui-Gon had not taken into account was how thoroughly he would ruin his Padawan's day.
You work for a highly unstable individual,
Minister Orth said, more than an hour after Qui-Gon had made his announcement and left.
Do you know this, Mr. Kenobi?
Of all the complaints Obi-Wan had ever had about Qui-Gon, unstable wasn't one of them.
This is very unusual for him, he said, as tactfully as he could manage.
Rael Averroes had spent most of this time trying to convince Princess Fanry that this was in fact a very serious problem. Fanry seemed amused by the whole thing, which, given that her elders were all losing their tempers and looking foolish, maybe wasn't so surprising. However, now Averroes turned on Obi-Wan, dark eyes blazing.
When did he revert to his childhood, huh? When did he decide all that prophecy nonsense was real?
As far as I can tell, Obi-Wan said, this morning.
Though Qui-Gon had, in fact, been talking about the possibility of a future vision for a couple of days now. His general interest in the prophecies had been growing for some months. Was it possible his master had lost his objectivity, even lost his way? Obi-Wan felt queasy. Padawans weren't supposed to be more objective than their masters. Their masters were meant to guide them to always be the stronger, surer ones. This dynamic had been reversed, and it discomfited him as much as zero gravity had when he'd hardly known which way was up.
We need to know whether the coronation and treaty ceremony are taking place as scheduled,
Captain Deren said in his deep, gravelly voice. He, alone of all the people in the banquet hall, remained calm.
And we need that information as soon as possible. Otherwise, I can't take proper security measures.
It's happening, Averroes growled. Trust me on that. Qui-Gon Jinn is going to get his head on straight, or...
Let me talk to him, Obi-Wan said.
Qui-Gon and Averroes would only clash more stridently in future versions of this argument, and would make little progress.
He might share more of his thoughts with me as his Padawan.
Slowly, Averroes nodded.
Minister Orth said, I'm glad you understand him because nobody else does.
Obi-Wan's heart sank. He never had figured Qui-Gon out. But today, maybe for the last time, he had to try.
Years before.
I'm in pursuit! Qui-Gon shouted into his comlink, hoping his voice would carry over the rush of air around his speeder bike as he swerved through jungle foliage.
Track me!
His voice cracked on the last word.
Great, he thought, but there was no time to dwell on anything except the chase.
He and Dooku were part of a Numidian Prime strike team, organized to find the notorious bounty hunter, Shenda Maul. She collected her bounties not by murdering individuals, which would have been bad enough, but by sabotaging passenger ships, detonating devices in crowded public areas, or once even releasing a deadly virus. Tens of thousands of deaths on 50 different planets were, for Maul, no more than collateral damage. The Jedi had tracked her to Numidian Prime, where she had a small stronghold and a handful of followers. But the followers had all been apprehended now, and it was up to Qui-Gon and his master to bring in Maul herself. He gunned his speeder bike, trying to fly over the thick jungle underbrush, but under the heavy palm leaves. Qui-Gon's Padawan braid streamed behind him, and he wished he'd worn goggles to protect his stinging eyes. No time for that. He crested the hill, which revealed the stony valley where they'd detected Maul's hideout. Qui-Gon pulled back on speed, bringing his speeder bike to as quiet a stop as possible. From now on, he'd travel on foot. Numidian Prime could be a swampy, treacherous world, but Shenda Maul had hidden herself on high ground. Qui-Gon could walk silently on leaves and vines that were still soft and green. Other than a few birds circling overhead, no fauna seemed to be in the area. Keeping one hand on his lightsaber, he pulled out his scanner to make sure he was heading toward the right coordinates. A few large, stony hills provided the likeliest place for Maul's hideout. Qui-Gon paused at the foot of one of them to put away his scanner and prepare for an altercation. Dooku would be along any moment now, but there was no guaranteeing his target wouldn't be...
Don't move,
said Shenda Maul. She leaned against a rock formation a few meters up the hill and pointed her blaster at his head. Qui-Gon went still. His hand remained on his lightsaber against an ordinary opponent. He would have trusted himself to pull his weapon in time to block blaster fire. But this was Shenda Maul. She was a Faline with ultra-fast reptilian reflexes, and even among the Faline, her reputation as a sharpshooter was unparalleled.
Tell me something, he said, remaining motionless. I've always heard you had perfect aim.
You heard right.
She tossed her head, her long black ponytail fell across her green shoulder.
If you doubt it, make a move and find out.
Qui-Gon had no intention of making a move. Yet.
If you can target any individual from a tremendous distance, why do you resort to bombs or viruses? Why do you kill thousands when you could kill only one?
Maul smiled.
I have a little game I play. I need more kills to win. Though, of course, I'm only competing with myself. That's the only competition that really matters, you know. More people ought to understand that.
Dooku would be along at any moment, he reminded himself. Master Dooku would have been tracking his speeder bike. All Qui-Gon needed to do was stall Maul for a brief time.
You're one of the trainees, aren't you?
She cocked her head, studying him.
Not much of a catch. The kind I'd usually throw back.
Qui-Gon didn't like being called a trainee, but that was the least of his problems.
I'm not yet a full Jedi, no.
I knew that,
Maul said.
I've eaten cheese older than you.
I'm 14.
14.
she hissed, as the Feline sometimes did when they were amused. He thought it best not to respond to that. Maul slid over a few rocks, practically slithered, while keeping the blaster at the ready. Qui-Gon felt sure her aim hadn't wavered for a moment. Now she was a full meter closer to him. She said,
"What am I to do with you?"
"The smartest thing to do would be to turn around and leave," Qui-Gon said. "Of course, that's what I want you to do, but it happens to be true. Others are coming. The sooner you leave, the more chances you'll have to lose them."
"When you'll just hunt me down again."
This too was true. Maul narrowed her eyes.
"Shall I tell you of my little game, trainee?"
"That sounds like you're going to," Qui-Gon replied evenly. His palm was becoming sweaty against the hilt of his lightsaber.
"It goes like this. I'm trying to kill one target of every age. At least up to 200. I can't go chasing ancients all the time. But I want all 200 years represented. So far, my oldest was a Wiffet who was 162. My youngest was 4 days. I count her as 0.
Maul said it all proudly. It turned Qui-Gon's stomach.
"Here's the thing."
Her grin widened.
"I've killed a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old. But that leaves me with a little gap. A gap you'd fill. Perfectly."
"She's going to kill me." Qui-Gon's hand tightened on his lightsaber. He'd just have to try to block her, even if it was futile. A flash of light exploded from the jungle, striking Shenda Maul. She screamed in agony, dropping her blaster and tumbling down the hillside to fall to the ground. Qui-Gon could no longer see her. Thick undergrowth blocked his view, but he could hear a strangled gurgling coming from her throat, scratching against the dirt as though she were clawing or kicking at the ground. Before Qui-Gon could ask what that light had been, the foliage rustled to reveal Master Dooku.
"You kill the helpless and brag of it,"
Dooku said, walking past Qui-Gon into the underbrush, focused only on Maul. Although Qui-Gon wanted to see his master, to show himself, he knew better than to interject himself into an encounter Dooku had well in hand.
"You think to murder my Padawan merely to fulfill your pitiful ambitions? You find yourself impressive, do you? You know nothing of true power."
Brilliant light flashed again and again. Qui-Gon still couldn't see it directly, though he could feel his skin prickling and his hair standing on end. The air tasted of ozone. None of that seemed to matter, not when he could hear Maul's wretched shrieks of pain. Then Shenda Maul's cries choked off. For one instant, Qui-Gon thought she was dead. But then he heard her moaning, brokenly. The sound wrenched him into action.
"Master, stop!"
He pushed his way through the underbrush to stand between Dooku and Maul. The assassin lay at his master's feet, curled in on herself, trembling.
"Please, I'm all right. We're taking her into custody. It's over."
Dooku's expression was unreadable at first, but slowly he lowered his hand.
"It's over," his master repeated.
Suddenly, he seemed almost normal again.
"You're all right, my Padawan?"
"Yes, Master."
Every other time Dooku had saved his life, Qui-Gon had thanked him. He couldn't know. What had his master done?
"Let me summon the others."
Dooku stepped away to speak into his communicator, while Qui-Gon remained there, guarding Shenda Maul as she shivered on the ground. Chapter 27.
No reply received. Qui-Gon sighed at the words on the screen. Count Dooku had proved an enigma ever since his sudden departure from the Order, and Qui-Gon had refrained from contacting him since, mostly to allow his former master some time in privacy. But now he needed his old master's advice more than ever.